Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Sexual assaults against individuals with developmental disabilities are often treated as isolated incidents. But a child with such a disability is roughly five times as likely to be sexually abused as a child in the general population. A new report released this week by Disability Rights Ohio suggests that such abuse is systemic and widespread. Joining us now in the studio is a policy analyst for Disability Rights Ohio, Mary Tarosi. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So what do we know about the incidence of sexual assault against individuals with developmental disabilities compared to the general and I guess the larger disabled populations, too?
We did quite a bit of research for our briefs to look at to give a little bit of background. We have at Disability Rights Ohio a responsibility to monitor the state agencies that provide services for individuals with disabilities, including developmental disabilities. And our team of attorneys and social workers that do that monitoring noticed a pattern over several years. And then within a short amount of time, they started to notice a pattern in a particular abuser group. And that was drivers of individuals with developmental disabilities.
So, in other words, people who drive them around, right?
Sorry, yes.
That's okay.
People who employed to drive an individual from one place to another. Mm-hmm. Because of that, they approached my team, which is the policy and communication team, to look into the issue and see if there was if the pattern had other elements to it. So I began to look at the research on, you know, is this an issue that comes up across the country? Are there numbers in Ohio as well as the U.S.? Initially, what I found actually is that there isn't a great amount of research on this issue.
Right.
A lot of what we know is anecdotal. It's kind of drawing, connecting the dots and drawing connections from the information that is available. And that is pretty typical of all sexual abuse because of the shame associated with sexual abuse, the lack of
underreporting is typical in general, right?
Yeah. Yes. So what information we did find pointed to the fact that indeed it is a huge problem. The Disability and Abuse Project recently did a survey of individuals with disabilities, I'm blanking on the exact number, but it was a majority of individuals with
I think it was 9 out of 10.
Yes, thank you. Mm-hmm. Actually said that they had experienced sexual abuse. So I started digging deeper and found that there do seem to be factors that put individuals with developmental disabilities at a particular vulnerability to sexual abuse, and indeed a vulnerability that makes them more likely to have a predator prey on them.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about sexual abuse of people with developmental disabilities. My guest is Mary Tarosi. She's policy analyst for Disability Rights Ohio. Disability Rights Ohio released this week a new series of reports that suggests that such abuse is systemic and widespread. Mary Tarosi just mentioned to us one of the patterns that's very common, shows up over and over again, is that people who shuttle people with developmental disabilities around, the drivers that take them to their shelter workshops, I guess, to classes, to workplaces, medical appointments, anything, wherever they might be taken, that there's a big pattern there. We're going to talk about that this hour. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org, or you can check out our Facebook page and you can join the conversation there. As you mentioned, the report notes that while individuals with disabilities are more likely than the general population to experience sexual abuse, the vulnerabilities of individuals with developmental disabilities are unique. So mm-hmm. How so? What are those unique vulnerabilities?
Well, it's important in the discussion of developmental disabilities to acknowledge that there is a very wide range of disability.
It's a continuum.
It is. So you have individuals that might have a cognitive impairment where their cognitive development doesn't match their age. Their physical age. You also have individuals who might have a developmental disability that is primarily a physical impairment. Their cognitive ability is perfectly typical, but they might be nonverbal or unable to move. So that aspect of it is important in kind of teasing out these vulnerabilities. The big vulnerability, the one of the primary vulnerabilities, is the fact that the services that are necessary for a lot of individuals with developmental disabilities leave them isolated, and of course, less able to disclose.
Why do the services? Can you tell us what you mean by the services leaving them isolated? How does that work?
So. A good example to go back to, and I don't want to make it seem like the only sexual abuses that we saw were among drivers, but to use the instances of individuals driving people with disabilities, you might have a situation where a person with a developmental disability, say using a wheelchair, needs to get from point A to point B, and the only way that they can do it is with an accessible vehicle. And so they use a service that drives them. And if there's only one individual in that vehicle, that driver now has an opportunity, if he or she is a predator, has an opportunity to get that person isolated. We had one case that came through Disability Rights Ohio, where a driver actually drove an individual to a field, an isolated field far away from everything else. Everyone else abused that individual. This was a nonverbal individual, abused that individual, and then drove them to their destination. And it took a long time to identify that that was happening. So it happened more than once. So that kind of isolation, that's an extreme. But even if you have an individual in a facility, they might be or in the community, they might be provided services for things like what we call ADLs or activities of daily living, which involve very personal touching, cleaning an individual, toileting an individual. And that typically doesn't happen in an open space. So again, that's a vulnerability where this person needs the service, but they're in a position where they don't want a lot of people around. And so again, a predator could take advantage of that.
The report also notes that because Ohio's developmental disability system, such as it is, has different policy and procedures from the system of supports for individuals with other disabilities. It focuses only on the developmental disability system. But how do these policies and procedures differ?
From system to system?
Yeah.
Well, one of the big factors is that you see a lot more individuals with developmental disabilities that are in facilities or receiving those kinds of very personal the services that are a lot more personal
intimate.
Yeah, intimate. Okay. Thank you. Thank you. So the system has to be incredibly robust and large. And because of that administrative bulk, there are a lot of different policies and procedures. The other example would be, or one of the other ones that we kind of address as overlapping with the developmental disability system, is the mental health system. Mm-hmm. There certainly are individuals in facilities related to mental illness. But that system has a different set of rules and a different way of dealing with the issue of abuse.
So what are, just in general now, what's the status quo when it comes to teaching people with developmental disabilities about what their rights are and about, you know, good touch, bad touch, and everything that we think we're teaching kids in the general population?
I don't know that there necessarily is an easy way to answer that question, in the sense that different caretakers might do different methods of training.
Okay.
Certainly, the the way of teaching, educating about sexuality and the risks and reducing the risk of sexual abuse is evolving. And I think it's hard to kind of capture where we are in the evolution in the state because different facilities and caretakers might approach it differently. People First does a really great training they try to use self-advocates, individuals with disabilities training other individuals with disabilities. And we think that's a great way to go. There is kind of the flip side of that is caretakers and I think to a lesser degree facilities, because I should note the Department of Developmental Disabilities does have trainings that they provide to individuals and facilities. That's something that the department has carefully created. But if you have a family caretaker, mm-hmm. for example, they might not be educating their child. They might be hesitant to.
It's always hard to have the talk.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. Especially. And in a lot of these situations, you have, again, an individual who might have a cognitive age that's lower than their physical age. And so they're having sexual responses physically, but the parents might be uncomfortable with the fact that they cognitively, seem younger. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I say it really does. There is no kind of standard prescriptive.
You talked about the patterns. You don't want to pick on drivers, but that's a pattern that's easily recognizable, that they're isolated with the victims. What sort of screening is in place for these kinds of positions when it comes to hiring?
Well, they are required to have background checks. But in our research, we found that there are some problems with the background check requirements. The biggest one is that there's a 90-day period to get that background check. And in the industry of service providers, there's a very high turnover rate. The pay is very low. Right. This is something that has been talked about quite a bit recently. The pay is very low. The conditions, the work is hard. And there's a lot of responsibility. So that all adds up to a system where you have high turnover. I believe the turnover rate is 34%.
So the demand is much higher than the supply for people willing to do it.
Yes, there are people that are willing to do it, but they might not stick around. They might find that if I'm getting paid $8 an hour to do backbreaking work where I have a lot of responsibility, I might be better off getting $10 an hour at McDonald's. Mm-hmm. So you have a very high turnover rate. And as a result, the folks that are looking, again, if you have a predatory situation, you might say, I can get this job for 3 months, abuse someone within that background check period, and then hop to the next person.
The 90-day background check period, is that set by the state?
I believe so, yes. Yes, it is. And that actually, we, Disability Rights Ohio, was part of a work group to look at some of the factors that could be improved. And that was one of the factors that work group flagged as something that could pretty easily be a policy change that could pretty easily be improved and could make a difference.
We are talking about the very high rate of sexual abuse of people with developmental disabilities. Fully 9 out of 10 are abused at some point in their life. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I've been talking to Mary Tarosi, policy analyst for Disability Rights Ohio. She referred just a few minutes ago to People First Ohio. We're going to hear from the executive director of that organization in just a minute. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. In Ohio, most people with developmental disabilities receive state benefits, and many live under the care of advocates who work hard to ensure their safety. Still, the prevalence of sexual abuse of people in that population is much higher than most Ohioans would guess. The incidence is outlined in a new report from Disability Rights Ohio. Still with us in the studio is policy analyst for Disability Rights Ohio, Mary Tarosi. Thanks again for joining us, Mary.
Thank you.
And joining us in the studio is the executive director for People First Ohio, Sadie Hunter. Welcome to the show, Sadie.
Good morning.
One of the big factors in the incidence of sexual abuse of people with developmental disabilities is the issue of dependence. They depend on a lot of different people to do things for them. We were talking earlier about the patterns they found in abuse with people who are isolated with them, drivers, caretakers, that kind of a thing, people who take care of them. How does that connect with the challenge of self-advocacy that I know is a primary tenet of People First Ohio, Sadie?
Well, you know, I mean, this, of course, is a touchy subject, no matter what it is, and nobody wants to talk about it. Everybody wants to put it under the carpet. The time is gone about pushing things under the carpet. Now is the time. We got to talk about it. We've got to get this going. People First had a call to action last year from our conference, and it was about health and safety because, you know, we want people to be employed. We want community inclusion, but they're not going to be sitting next to somebody on a bus who's had their background checked. If we want them to be truly in the community, we've got to educate them. We have got to empower them to know what a perpetrator is, who can be a perpetrator. And, you know, in our trainings, we use people who've already had those problems, who've already been molested. I mean, all types of abuse, they're the ones who are our trainers.
You mean people who are developmentally disabled are
Yes.
trainers?
Mm-hmm.
How does that work? I mean, Mary Tarosi mentioned earlier that the continuum is so it has a lot of depth and has a lot of breadth. There's a lot of a lot of factors that go into any individual's personality and what their needs are and abilities are.
Exactly. You know, we don't turn anyone away on our trainings, and we can see if somebody's not exactly getting it. But in our trainings, we use scenarios, and they're true life stories. And so when the self-advocates come in, we talk about we don't use pet names for our body parts. We talk about we use the words because if they have to go to court, we have so many people that they say they're not reliable witnesses, and then it goes untreated. And so we have to teach them and give them the knowledge of if this happens, this is what you do, this is what you don't do. But it has to be in people first language, which means for everyone to understand. And our program, we have pictures and like what hitting is, you know, what stealing is, and who are those people. And so it's very, very important to People First is that for our people to be safe. It's great to have all community. It's great if you're going to get a job, but you can't go to a job if you're being molested at home.
I guess that sexual assault is just one of many crimes that are perpetrated at a higher rate against people with developmental disabilities, right?
Exactly. You know, there's theft. You know, people think that, you know, if someone borrows a cigarette from somebody with disability, you know, that's theft. You know, that's how that belongs to them. And like a staff go, hey, can I borrow you a cigarette? It's just that fine line sometimes.
Uh-huh.
And so the scenarios that we do and we act out, it's all those type of things, those gray areas, what's right and what's not right, what you would do in this circumstances.
A lot of people infantilize the disability, the developmentally disabled community in general. That's been a big issue over the last 30 or 40 years now, is the whole issue of sexuality in the community. So first you have the issue of whether they should be introduced to the idea of sex anyways, and then you have to go to that other layer of sexual abuse. That's touchy.
It's really touchy, and a lot of times parents don't want it.
Right.
They just will refuse. And right now, we do have one for under 14 and to 18, but ours right now is from 18 up because we just don't have it, which I think is horrible. We have the training, but we just not been asked to do the training.
Well, and I wanted to ask if we didn't talk, Mary Tarosi, about just gender differences, the statistics and how they differ gender-wise and also age-wise. Do we know anything about that?
Well, excuse me. I think that there we do see more the statistics indicate that there is more abuse happening when individuals are younger, but it certainly does happen as adults as well. There are more, I believe the statistics indicate that there are more women that are sexually abused than men, but the prevalence of sexual abuse of men with disabilities and developmental disabilities is much higher than men or boys
in the general
population.
Right. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the issue of sexual assault of people who are developmentally or intellectually disabled. My guests, Mary Tarosi of Disability Rights Ohio, just put out a series of reports this week. And also Sadie Hunter, she's executive director for People First Ohio. It's an advocacy group, and they're working, and we're talking about their role in educating people with disabilities about what their rights are and how to understand what's happening to them. If you have a question, comment, want to join the conversation, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Mike in Columbus, you're on the air. You're a retired special ed teacher.
Yes, I taught multi-handicapped. That means both mentally and physically severely handicapped kids for 30 years. We have this terrible conundrum. We want to protect these our children and the adults too, of course. But how do we guarantee that every moment? How do we say that 5 years ago at 2 p.m. when I might have been alone with a child, I didn't physically or sexually or in some way abuse them? There's no way you can protect yourself. As rewarding as I found the career, I've found myself recently saying to young people, especially men, and I think we need more men teachers than ever because there's so few men in our homes, don't become a special ed teacher. You can never protect yourself enough to possibly have someone say, where were you at 2 p.m. 3 years ago on Wednesday the 27th?
Did that happen to you a lot, Mike? Did that happen to you?
Sexually, no, but I had that with physical abuse a couple of times. And one time, there was a case where I was at meetings virtually all day. I was in the classroom for 15 minutes while there were three other adults there. And then the child had the mom thought that the child had been bruised up. So the very next day, we had the nurse completely check, look for no bruises, no nothing. Mm-hmm. 2 weeks later, Children's Services comes in. They're screaming at me. And it was a terribly frightening experience. And they wound up, I don't know what the agenda was. Very confusing.
Okay. Well, I mean, I think you're bringing up a pretty good issue. It is a conundrum. I mean, on one hand, we've got people like Mike. He devoted 30 years of his life to this, and he understands, you know, why people are worried about this kind of thing. But Sadie Hunter, what about that other side of the equation, the people who maybe are doing a good job? How do you attract people to these professions?
It's very hard. It's so hard to do that, especially with the money that they're giving.
And you hear what Mike's saying.
I understand exactly what he's saying, because it does happen that people say, oh, you know, you said this. And people with disabilities do tell stories. So, you know, you have to kind of figure it out, you know, put something in place, you know, put something in place that you can for protection, that there's always two people somewhere, you know, in a classroom. I do believe there's supposed to be two people in that classroom at all times. Mm-hmm. So those kind of things. But those bathroom issues and all that kind of stuff, you never know, you know, who's going to say what. It is. That's a really, really hard thing. And
It brings up an important issue that we tried to get at in the reports as well, and that is the issue of appropriate responses to claims and reports of abuse. So I don't want to assume that this is what happened in Mike's case, but we did see cases where what we looked at in our instances was major unusual incidents, or MUIs, that the Department of Developmental Disabilities collects whenever there looks like there might be something inappropriate going on. So it's the MUI covers a lot. And we looked at all of the ones that were flagged as possibly being sexually related. And what we found in a couple of instances was someone who instance of rape that they were investigating was found unsubstantiated. However, it was clear that this person, either the department and the facility knew that they had been abused, or there was a ton of evidence that they had been abused in the past, but they had never received appropriate therapy, appropriate services to deal with that kind of trauma, and they weren't being treated in a trauma-informed way, recognizing that this person might be extra sensitive to particular touching. Mm-hmm. That kind of thing can help prevent these kinds of, you know, to use Sadie's term of phrase, stories from mm-hmm. turning into something that is inappropriate.
Okay, Mike, thanks for that call. Charlotte, you're on the air. Hi, Charlotte.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. With regard to credibility, I recall the case in 2005 in which a young lady at Columbus Public Schools reported repeated sexual abuse by classmates to her father, and the principal ended up being dismissed because the only way anybody believed her was when the perpetrators were bragging in their math class by sharing videos of the assault. I'm wondering, as difficult as it is for people with all their faculties, particularly women, to be abused, to be believed about rape or assault, how many of these children are reporting, how many of these disabled people are reporting abuse without ever being taken seriously?
Mm-hmm.
That's the other half of that coin.
Right, Charlotte. Thanks for that call. Mary Tarosi?
Yes, that we found that is a huge problem, and there is a lot of research that substantiates that. In fact, one of the reasons why it's so underreported is that people with disabilities are not believed on much less serious issues.
Yeah.
And so when it comes to something that's so private and so serious, that they aren't taken seriously. There is that credibility bias against people with developmental disabilities. It's believed if you have someone who's perfectly, again, cognitively typical, but they might be nonverbal, they might not be believed because it's assumed that because they can't speak for themselves that they aren't able to understand what has happened to them, which of course is not necessarily true at all.
Mm-hmm.
Or if someone does have a cognitive impairment, it's assumed that maybe because they don't understand time perfectly or think very literally that they're not able to understand that they were abused.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a huge problem.
Mm-hmm. Sadie Hunter?
Well, I don't think our community values them as full community citizens, and so that's a huge problem. And when they go into, they're scared, you know, the old saying, you don't bite the hand that feeds you. You know, this could be the person that gives them their breakfast, gets them to the movie theater. So is that going to go away? They think about things like that.
Do they take, I mean, isn't it true, too, or isn't it possible that their threats to them are even taken? It's bad enough for somebody, as Charlotte mentioned, with their full fact. I mean, with everything going for them who are threatened as children or whatever, threatened with some kind of retribution if they report.
Oh, definitely. I mean, a lot of times they'll say, oh, well, they told me, you know, that they would tell my dad on me, you know, and they don't want their dad to know that they had sex or that something happened to them because they're going to look down. OK, there's something else I didn't do right with my disability that, you know, another thing that somebody's going to have against me.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's so many people out there who want to have to tell, but this, to being scared, being believed, police. I mean, I've dealt with police many, many times and been called in, and the police have just, they don't understand. And I think that's one of our things is our attorneys, our policemen, people at the hospital understand when they come in, who's going to come in. They don't know what a rape kit is. They don't know what's going to happen. You know, like in our training, you know, I just say, do not wash yourself. You know, we talk about those things. You just call somebody who you love, somebody who you trust, and we're going to do that. I will be there. We'll find somebody to be there. You will not be alone. And that's the thing is people are scared to be alone, that they're going to have to go with this by themselves.
Communication issues are a part of this whole thing, too. They're just, I mean, there could be a lot of things. They could be almost nonverbal.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So yeah. How do they even report in the first place, let alone be believed when they tell their story?
Well, people who are nonverbal often have ways of communicating, and sometimes it is a little bit, the method of communicating is not necessarily intuitive to someone who doesn't know the individual. Mm-hmm. So that is in the research, we found that that is a big problem with the interviews of an individual after they report. So they might report to someone that they care for and they have a method of communicating by gesture or through a assistive technology. But when you have the interviewer, they are uncomfortable with communicating that way, or they're not sure that the interpreter is not changing the story. Mm. And indeed, that is an issue as well. Mm-hmm. If you have to have someone to kind of be that middle interpreter, is the message getting changed? Communication is absolutely a big consideration.
When you're doing the trainings, Sadie Hunter, for by way of People First Ohio, what's it like? What are the participants? Do you get that? Are they nodding? Do they know what you're talking about?
They do.
In terms
know.
Of the problem, the larger problem.
Well, when we start off, we talk the words, what a perpetrator is, how you can get hurt. We talk about sexuality, who you are as a person. You're a man, you're a woman. You know, in our field, we have people who are transgender. Mm-hmm. And we have all types of people with disabilities that are in the regular world, but no one wants to actually talk about those issues. And sometimes that's behavior. Sometimes that can get them in trouble. I know a gentleman, you know, that this has happened to, but we got him into an organization that helps him along with that, to know not to get, how to get hurt if he goes into a club, you know, like mm-hmm. that.
Mm-hmm. We are talking about sexual abuse of people, of individuals who are developmentally or intellectually disabled. We'll continue the conversation. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Someone who has an intellectual or developmental disability is much more likely to be sexually abused than the general population. He or she is less likely, however, to be his or her own advocate in such cases. We're talking about the incidence of sexual abuse of people who are developmentally disabled, the risk factors to watch for, and the importance of self-advocacy. Still with us in the studio is policy analyst for Disability Rights Ohio, Mary Tarosi. Mary, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you.
Disability Rights Ohio put out a series of reports this week on the topic, and also Executive Director for People First Ohio, Sadie Hunter. Thanks again, Sadie, for joining us.
Love it. Thank you.
And joining us now by phone is the director of the Disability and Abuse Project, clinical psychologist Dr. Nora Baladarian. Her practice focuses on trauma and abuse. She conducts seminars and trainings for first responders, agency personnel, and service providers. Welcome to the show, Dr. Baladarian.
Thank you so much.
You've issued 10 tips for parents or family members whose loved ones fall into one of the risk categories for people who are developmentally disabled. The first tip is to know and believe that abuse can happen to your loved one. It's the first tip of them all, so that must be a pretty big issue.
It's a huge issue, and one of the reasons is that parents are not informed by any agency, at least to my knowledge, that abuse is a huge risk for their children. Now, not only are they not told that, but it's a horrible thing to learn and to know. But as parents, it's our responsibility to know what are the risks for our children. And I think it's incumbent upon us to finally say, okay, I get it. And a lot of parents tell me, I don't want to talk about this, it's too scary. Well, it's even scarier for the child who's being abused sexually. And it's pretty scary after the fact. And so I'm saying before the fact, there's a lot of scary things in our culture, you know, and we acknowledge them, like here in California, earthquakes, you know, for example. Mm-hmm. But hardly anyone says, don't tell me about earthquakes. Don't tell me. I don't want to address it. Forget it. But they do about sexual abuse, which is so common for children and adults with developmental disabilities. So that's the first thing. And not acknowledging it leads to not seeing the signs when the signs are right in front of our face.
The second tip is to become familiar with the signs of abuse. Are those signs different for people who are developmentally disabled?
They're basically the same, although there are additional, I would say, permutations. And we just put out a campaign called the Rule Out Abuse Campaign. And in part two, I delineate the signs and symptoms of abuse for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities.
Mm-hmm.
The campaign is for health practitioners who often are so focused on the disability as well as the parents. They attribute the changes, which are signs of abuse, to the disability rather than thinking, oh, there may be abuse as a new factor in this child's life. So that's why we've just started the Rule Out Abuse campaign for doctors and healthcare practitioners, so that when parents take their children to see them and say, what the heck is going on with my child? They're all of a sudden blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
Then the practitioner has right at the top of the list abuse.
And the signs are things just like anyone else, signs of not sleeping well, not eating well, mood changes, maybe harming themselves, that sort of thing.
All of those things. So maybe now needing to sleep with a parent in their bed rather than not. Showing I work a lot with schools where the teachers have abused the children, and these children inevitably indicate an eagerness not to go to school. They'll do whatever they can not to go to school. But the parents, believing that the school is the best place for them with special ed teachers and, you know, all of the support, force them to go to school and don't recognize that that is a sign of abuse.
So once you detect one of these signs, we were talking earlier about how you suss out whether it is maybe any number of things versus actual abuse, physical abuse, sexual abuse, that sort of thing.
That's right. And that's why I think it's important to consult with your psychologist or your primary care provider and discuss abuse as a possible thing to rule out, along with onset of a new illness or increased seizure disorder, which could be a sign of abuse, by the way, because a lot of seizures are caused by stressors. In other words, additional seizure disorder is common among people who have a seizure disorder when additional stressors occur. So it's just important to address these issues. Now, where could the abuse be happening? Mary Tarosi mentioned bus drivers, which is very true, but it's also in the school classroom. It's also basically any place where the child is with a trusted caregiver.
Including at home.
Including at home.
Do you think that, people on the other side of the equation, the people outside of the home, are any better prepared to identify, you know, that there's possible abuse as people in the home, the parents, the caretakers?
The parents are generally the best ones because they spend the most time with their kids, and they know their kids the best.
Mm-hmm.
And the parents that I work with are devoted, loving parents who have take their kids to every, you know, possible service, and a lot of those services are in the home, but they absolutely notice when their child is unhappy, when their child is now sad, when their child is now afraid, when their child is having nightmares. And it's confusing. It shouldn't be confusing. They should be saying, oh, this is a constellation that I know about. This is a constellation of signs that indicate abuse or something very wrong may be happening that they could be witnessing.
You know, Sadie Hunter said just a few minutes ago, Sadie Hunter, executive director for People First Ohio, that their self-advocacy training sessions are only for people 18 and older. Obviously, abuse knows no age limit. It happens more frequently, Mary Tarosi said, in younger people. What about that? What needs to change to reach them as well?
Well, I don't know that we know that. There's no reason in my mind to think that abuse is less common among people with developmental disabilities who are younger than older. The research, however, is almost absent, and that's why we did the 2012 National Survey on Abuse of People with Disabilities
mm-hmm.
that Mary used in her report. We do know that at the latest count, the Sullivan study on children showed that kids with disabilities are 3.4 times more likely than their generic counterparts to be victims of abuse. So if you do the math, so quickly do the math, Anne, you know, what is 3.4 times 1 in 4?
Mm-hmm.
Never mind, I already did it for you. It's 85%.
Thank you.
Uh-huh. And for boys, it's 1 in 6 in generic, and times 3.4 is 58.
Mm-hmm.
So those are pretty high numbers. That's nearly 60, right? So you have nearly 60% of the boys and 85% of the girls are sexually assaulted or abused by the time they're 18. So if you're starting at 18, you're late.
Right.
Plus, we know about the effect of abuse, sexual assault, or other kinds of assault, but we're talking today about sexual assault. The effect of sexual assault on any individual is huge, and it covers every area of life, right? In addition, we are aware of ACEs, the program that tells us that abuse in early life will generally lead to physical anomalies and difficulties in later life. So we need to start very, very, very early in abuse risk reduction practices on the part of the parents and the schools, which is where most children are going to be.
I think my sense has been over time and covering this issue for 35 years that a lot of people still don't understand that people who are developmentally disabled can be just as traumatized and damaged by this kind of abuse as anybody.
Yes, there's a lot of denial, and when I hear things like I already heard on your radio show, that, you know, people think it's an anomaly, that it, when it happens, it's, you know, one in a million, or it's a, you know, it doesn't happen that often. And I'm so glad and so grateful to you for doing this show so that the public, but particularly those who respond to abuse, so health practitioners, law enforcement, child protective services, can have another chance to learn that this is more the rule than the exception.
You noted in that groundbreaking survey from 2012 that nearly half of the victims with disabilities did not report abuse to authorities because most thought it would be futile. And you go on to note that for those who did report abuse, more than half said nothing happened. And in fewer than 10% of the cases, was the perpetrator even arrested? So that really gives credence to those who do not report. Why go through
right.
that, too?
Exactly. But it gives us a guideline. It tells us we have a lot of work to do with child protective services, adult protective services, and law enforcement personnel who want to do a good job, but they don't receive the training that equips them to interact effectively with children who have intellectual and communication disabilities. And I'm not saying it's their fault. I'm saying that it's kind of the fault of whoever designs the training and funds the training, because they should be equipped to deal with and interact with everyone in their community. But it takes a special skills. It takes special knowledge to interact effectively and to interview children and adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities. And it's not that tough. It's just that they should receive that training. And had they received that training, I think those numbers would be way different. But there's also the thing that I think that Sadie mentioned, and that is the disregard and prejudice against people with developmental disabilities, that they're not as important, that they always lie, that they always blah, 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 and they're not honored and respected. And I think that our children are our most important resource. And as a matter of fact, in that same report, we also note that very few of the children or the victims, child or adult, are ever offered mental health treatment after the sexual assault.
Right, right. You know,
and the few that did say it was very helpful. 83% said that the therapy was very helpful, but less than 5% of the victims were offered the free therapy that's offered in most states to the victims of crime programs.
Sadie Hunter, you were talking about training first responders and that kind of thing. Tell us what you're learning from that.
Well, it's not been a whole lot.
Because there hasn't been that much.
There hasn't been that much interest in
There's been a lot of interest in training first responders to the issues of mental health. I think that Bradley Cooper movie, the name of it is escaping me right now, but he had bipolar disorder, and they said that was a classic example of what to do as a first responder with a mental health issue. It's different for people with developmental disabilities.
And the problem is that lack of education and freedom. People with disabilities have never had that freedom to make choices and to say something. So they lack in, they're not going to report sexual abuse because of the education. They don't know that it is. And so when a policeman comes in, and I've heard policemen do great jobs, just wonderful jobs. And then they look at me and go, but he would go from one subject to another. Well, that's what he does. But if you actually listen to everything, there's a gentleman that I know that has reported abuse many, many times, but because he's not credible, it continues to happen to him. He continues to be the person that people go for and prey on because they know that
no one will believe him.
Nobody. That's the thing. Nobody's going to believe me.
Is there anything special, Dr. Baladarian, about the predators? Are they just generic predators, or do they tend to go after people like this, either because they know they have a less chance of getting caught, or because there's something in their predatory drive that drives them in that direction?
I don't think that there's anything particular about those who sexually abuse children with disabilities versus those who abuse those without disabilities.
Uh-huh.
It's pretty much, whenever there's an opportunity, they're going to take it. I have heard, however, that some predators have learned that the children, now I don't believe what Sadie was just saying, and I don't think she meant to say it this way, that people are not credible, that they are seen as not credible.
Right.
It's prejudice.
Prejudice. I'm sorry, yeah.
Okay, yeah. And so predators know that. They know that people have this huge prejudice against folks with disabilities, and that whatever they do, the victim is less likely to be believed because of the prejudice. And I think we ought to start using language like that, because of the prejudice, not because of the qualities of the victim.
The other thing that's
very interesting that Ruth Lupison, Dr. Lupison in New Mexico said, is that a person is a victim and has a developmental disability, they're very much likely not to be believed, whatever they say. However, if they are a suspect, everything they say is likely to be believed.
That can and will be used against them, right?
Yes, exactly. So it's a pure prejudicial, non-well-thought-out kind of approach. So I think that back to training, we need to be asking our police officers, captains, IACP, whoever it is, to really ramp up training for those responders upon whom we depend to help. And then a lot of the victims that I serve say two things. One is, thank you for believing me, and how come the police didn't believe me? So, the training programs, there's training videos available from the Department of Justice, Office of Victims of Crime, that police departments and first responders could use. The fact that they're free, the fact that they're good, the fact that they have training guides with them could be used, but I think Sadie was right when she said they're not interested, and that's our biggest problem.
Well, Dr. Nora Baladarian, I want to thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. I'm so thrilled that you're doing this, and this is the kind of work that you're doing that I think that Mary and Sadie and I completely applaud, and that is the knowledge has to be increased. Believability has to be increased, and it shows our caring for those who are very vulnerable in our culture.
Dr. Nora Baladarian, she's director of the Disability and Abuse Project, which conducted a groundbreaking survey from 2012. We'll have a link to that survey on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Also, Sadie Hunter, thanks to you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Sadie Hunter, she's executive director for People First Ohio, and Mary Tarosi, policy analyst for Disability Rights Ohio. Thank you as well.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks to everybody. Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, Associate Producer Amy Jurovich, Assistant Producer Rachel Quimby, Allsides Interns Michael Hepburn, Shahina Sagiri, Hannah Palmer, and Abdulrahman Al-Ruweishan. Video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Thanks again for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.